Yeah, lots more energy. I need to get back. In my face, yeah. Nikki's at 112. She's, Alice was 40. So I just slacked. She's messed up.
I haven't seen the.
Judge? Look, I said to myself.
We're getting ready to go now.
It's some. That's up to you, Leo. Yeah, the tape's on, I think. No, we haven't. He hasn't gambled in yet. So.
The Senate Judiciary Budget Committee Division will come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 18th, the year 2008, and welcome to the position. Mr. Turner, you were going to give a brief overview of this.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members, I'll do a quick overview of the Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations for the Judiciary Budget Division. There are four recommendations in all of them reductions. The first is a $1,781,000 reduction for the Supreme Court for fiscal year 2009. Of this amount, the Governor recommends that $1,165,000 come from Supreme Court operations and $516,000 from Civil Legal Services. This figure was arrived at by backing out judicial salaries from Supreme Court operations and then making a 4% cut on the remaining operating budget. It would eliminate almost the entire 2009 compensatory adjustment enacted last year for the Supreme Court. And there's one other issue, and that is the reductions are to be carried out in fiscal year 2010 and 2011 tails. The Governor's recommending that the Civil Legal Services cut of $516,000 be extended in tails. Last year's increase for civil legal was a one-time appropriation. So for civil, this would be a cut in tails that probably wasn't our intent last year. The second reduction is $282,000 for the Court of Appeals. Last year, the legislature created a three-judge panel and funded compensation increases in the Court of Appeals. Most of this cut would come out of the comp adjustment. Once again, the cut is 4% of the operating budget after backing out judicial salaries. Then the largest cut, $7,039,000 for the district courts. This represents a 4% cut of the court's operating budgets after one, backing out the judicial salaries, and two, backing out the state mandated services, psych evals, guardian ad litem, interpreters, and informa pauperis. It should be noted that the court has requested $1.9 million supplement this year for state mandated services. Then finally, there's a 4% reduction in the operating budget of the Board of Public Defense, totaling $2,781,000. This represents pretty much the entire 2009 compensatory adjustment enacted last year. And that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions of Mr. Turner? Are they not? Got a request for an early opportunity. Judge Knudsen has to.
Mr. Chairman, we can have Sue DeSalle from the Court Administrator's Office start off. That's right, and I can follow her.
Certainly. Glad to accommodate.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the division. My name for the record is Sue DeSalle. I'm the State Court Administrator. We have today, in addition to my testimony, Judge Knudsen and Judge Lucy Whelan, the Chief Judge of the 4th District, and we hope that Judge Tom Neville will be here as well, representing the 3rd Judicial District. as you just reviewed, a week ago or so, the governor recommended a $9.1 million cut to the judicial branch budget. And as you recall from our testimony several weeks ago, we already are suffering from a shortfall of about $13 million for our personnel cost. And on top of that, we have requested this $1.9 million in mandated services cost as a result of increases that we're experiencing there. So this cut on top of this $13 million plus the $1.9 we're experiencing would have very real and publicly apparent impacts on our ability to deliver justice in Minnesota. As I indicated, this $13 million is resulting in about 207 positions that we have kept open or have abolished branch-wide. This represents 7% of our entire workforce. And we are already experiencing some significant reduction in services to the public and in delays. We have been aggressively managing our budget. We expect to live within that that we were given. But as we indicated last time we were here, there's no way that we would be able to absorb the $1.9 million in mandated services cost increases that we're experiencing. So given our current situation, just handling the 08-09 current budget, to take the cut that is recommended by the governor will result in about a loss of another 222 positions. We have no place else to cut. We have people. That's another 8% of our staff, so that essentially in 1 year we will have lost 15% of our workforce in the judicial branch. Now, just to give you some idea of the magnitude of this cut, what you have here in this chart is the allocation of personnel in the trial court, actually FTEs, to the processing of different kinds of cases. The governor's cut translates into about 193 positions at the trial court. So to take this cut would be the equivalent of wiping out everybody that we have working in juvenile, in major or minor criminal, parking and probate, even family. So a cut of this magnitude on top of what we're already experiencing is clearly going to be a huge issue. So what are we doing about it, and what steps are we considering? First of all, of course, curtailing hours of service at courthouses around the state. We already have in three of our judicial districts, the courthouses, the public counters are closed at one half a day a week, and this, of course, would be extended statewide. In addition, because this is not just a 09 problem, but we understand a 10 and 11, if we get a cut of this magnitude in 09, a base cut to 10 and 11, we feel that it's absolutely essential to begin considering how many court locations can be afforded in Minnesota. So on the table right now are the possibility of closing or essentially closing some of the low-volume courthouses around the state. And in your packet is a map, just to give you some idea, a map of counties. There are 12 counties in Minnesota that have no resident judge, and we'd be looking at those and perhaps others. And so that's kind of in the greater Minnesota area. In the metro area, we are looking at closing some of the suburban court facilities. And Judge Whelan will be here and talking to you a little bit about that situation in Hennepin. The 10th District has already announced that it will be closing its Cottage Grove satellite facility, which serves the cities of Woodbury, Cottage Grove, Newport, in St. Paul Park. All of these people who come here now will require to be driving to Stillwater to handle their matters.
So, do you want some interruption on that?
Sure.
I was curious to know what, like in the satellite ones in the metropolitan area, how many satellite courts are there in each county?
In Hennepin, there are three, and in Ramsey, there is one. And over the years, we have closed these down and consolidated them over time. But given the cuts of this magnitude, we have to find a way to create economies of scale. The one thing that is significant, though, when you think about these closings, these 12 counties with no resident judge, if we were to close all of them and eliminate all of the staff and somehow assume that all that work could just be absorbed, you're only talking about $2.2 million. So getting to $9 million is a very difficult problem. And so we are having to look at many things. But I think that, you know, fundamentally we're looking at other things like shutting down drug courts. You know, we just got some funding from the legislature this last time. As a result, in this last several years, we've been able to begin 21 drug courts all over the state, serving, I don't know, something like 30 counties. These are showing great results for avoiding expensive jail and prison bed costs and for reducing recidivism. But these are issues that we'd have to look at. Certainly cutting services to pro se litigants. Just to give you some idea of the magnitude of the numbers here in Hennepin County, it has a very extensive self-help center that services 33,000 walk-in customers last year, another 10,000 that have used its services contacting it by email or telephone. So you can imagine the cuts to this area are going to impact many, many people. We'll have to be looking at reducing civil legal services, of course. You're going to hear from those folks a little bit later. But obviously, this means more people, low-income people, that are going to be having to go without lawyers, and this will only exacerbate the court's pro se problem that we just discussed. And, of course, without adequate staff and without sufficient funds for interpreters, psychiatric exams, for guardians ad litem, and jurors and the like, we're going to see significant delays and quickly building backlogs within the judicial branch. And to give you some idea of what we estimate would happen under this kind of a cut, we believe that given the fact that Minnesota courts handle about 2 million cases every year, this cut on top of what we're already experiencing, we believe is going to result in a magnitude of backlog cases, something approaching 250,000 by the end of 2010. So, you know, at some point, as cases back up and delays happen and justice delayed is justice denied, we're going to run into the problem of the constitutional guarantee, which in Minnesota is that all cases, both civil and criminal cases, have to be handled promptly and without delay. So, and added to all this reality is the fact, as you know, that courts are counter-cyclical in economic times. You know, our business generally goes up when the economy goes down, and then I think we can expect that likely we're going to see more activity in areas of crime and domestic violence and in all civil matters, all kinds of civil matters, divorces and the like. So this is the difficulty that we expect to happen if a cut of that magnitude would have to be taken. Beyond the delays in scheduling of cases and disposing of cases, we already are seeing delays in the administrative processing of these matters that are only going to get worse with a cut such as that proposed. We're beginning to see delays in entering criminal case data on court computers. And what does that mean? That means that criminal history records are going to be inaccurate. These are the records that, as you know, are relied on every day all over the state for arrest, for release, and for sentencing decisions. We're going to see delays in processing of warrants and arrest detain orders, which means the potential for some increased public safety risks. Same thing with updating satisfied warrants. This could lead to unlawful arrests and incarceration.
What are the implications of that on the period that's, you know, imposed on currently so you don't arrest somebody or at least don't arrest somebody?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, you know, I have a hearing deficit, so I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Can you hear me now?
Mm-hmm. No. I can't hear you now.
Yeah. See, I think these are just recording. I don't think they amplify. So could you just repeat the question?
I'm just curious as to what the legal significance of not purging those warrants from the file.
Well, we can be sued and have been sued for unlawful arrests and detention. I think that's the impact of that. And as I said, you know, the delays in getting some of this disposition information, of course, is that, you know, history records are not up to date, and that poses a lot of problems for police and prosecutors and courts even in terms of their decisions. So these are not insignificant issues. And we already are seeing in the courts that in these areas, sometimes a week, several weeks delay in entering the information that's come out of court into our court computers. So these are real problems that we're experiencing now and are only going to get worse. And finally, of course, we're going to see increased wait in line time and for customers coming to the court. Just as an example, in Ramsey County, it's now about a 2.5-hour wait for citizens coming to meet with hearing officers to deal with traffic tickets and the like. The other thing I think we want to bring to your attention is the fact that I think that you can be sure to see some collateral effects if there are cuts of this magnitude to the courts. If we are not able to timely deal with these cases and they begin to back up, you're going to see increased jail costs and jail overcrowding as a result. For those that are out of custody, they're going to stay out of custody longer, so that potentially poses increased risk to public safety. For civil commitment cases that are backed up, we are going to see more expensive and unnecessary hospital beds for folks that are awaiting these hearings. And this includes the sexual predator cases. And some of the costs are as much as $700 a day in hospitals. And also in the CHIPS area, backup of these cases means increased costs to counties for out-of-home placements that are going to be longer. And finally, as you know, the courts collect something like $200 million every year that come in. If we have to take the cuts to our staff of this magnitude, we will be forced to divert the staff that are now working on traffic and parking and collection efforts to more important things, to more important kinds of cases, and that certainly is going to slow the revenue flow to all of these governmental units and to many local programs that rely on funding. So now that's just kind of a big picture that I've tried to give you, you know, on the macro level, and I would like to now call on our judges to talk a little bit about their perspective, how this is going to impact their courts, their local justice systems, and their citizens. And if I might first call on Judge Knutson.
Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. It's a pleasure to be here, not under these circumstances, certainly, but it's terrific to see each of you again. I want to give you a little bit of a local flavor, and from my experience as a district court judge, sitting down in Hastings, down in Dakota County, I'm in the 1st Judicial District, and our district encompasses seven counties, two or three of the fastest-growing counties in the state, Dakota, Carver, and Scott. And our district never really gets caught up on funding or on staff because we're continuing to grow and our caseload continues to go up because of that population increase. So as we do our analysis of our district, we're 12 employees short throughout the First Judicial District. The cut that's recommended would result in a layoff of, in addition to the 12 employees that we're currently short of, it would result in an actual layoff of 18 employees of our 198 employees, which excludes the court reporters and the law clerks. So we're looking at about a 9% staffing cut in the First Judicial District, where we've got growing caseloads and growing population. And you know what, we can talk about judges working harder, and when I first took the bench, I thought, well, you know what, I'm going to show the citizens out here how hard we really can work, and I'm going to work through lunch, I'm going to not take breaks, and we're going to go till 6, 7 o'clock at night, and if that's what it takes to get rid of our backlog and process cases, then that's what it is. But you know, things don't work that way. You can't keep juries and jurors longer than 4:30 or 5 o'clock because they have daycare issues. You can't pay overtime to the sheriff's deputies as bailiffs to protect your courtroom and to protect the public. You can't keep paying workers' comp payments to the court reporters that need breaks. And so I mean, that's just one example of we're looking at all the different ways of trying to increase our efficiency, do better, do more cases, do them faster, and the judges are capable of that. But it's what feeds us, and that's the staff. That's the staff that Ms. Dosell just went through and outlined kind of what they do on a regular basis, organizing the files, taking the filings, recording them all, entering it into the computer, preparing our daily calendar, and then processing the calendar once we make our orders and issue our decisions. But it really comes down to people, and it's you know, it's not really this budget isn't about the judges, and it's not about court staff really. It's about the constituents and the citizens of the state of Minnesota that all of us serve. And it's about the 2 million cases and hundreds of thousands of people who each year bring to the court some of the most important matters in their lives for help. And it's about the abused spouses seeking protection. It's about the neglected children seeking safety. It's conflicting businesses seeking resolution. It's divorcing couples seeking finality and injured people seeking stability. So the question, when we start cutting staff and we're not able to physically process the cases, the question becomes, who do we send away? Who do we ignore? Who do we delay? Those are the choices we'll have to make if these additional positions have to remain open and layoffs, and these layoffs are obviously going to be necessary under this proposal. So the question is, who among these real-life examples should receive priority when there are insufficient staff to process these cases in a timely manner? Should it be the sex offender who's about to be released from prison and is facing civil commitment as a sexually dangerous person? Should it be the wife who came to court for an order for protection after discovering her husband's journal that describes his plans and preparations to kill her and the children? Should it be the elderly man who lost a leg in an accident and cannot obtain needed medical services because the two companies that insure them can't agree on who's primarily responsible for payment? Or should it be the preteen girl who's regularly beaten by her mother with an electric cord and who writes a letter to the court pleading, please help me? These are actual cases. These are the issues and the people and the situations that we deal with on a regular basis and that are filing cases for us to decide. So as you think about the courts and think about the judicial system and what is going to happen to us, this is the reality. I know you've got a very difficult situation in front of you, and what I'm asking you to do is what you've done every year of your service here, is to recognize the reality of the courts here, recognize the impacts that these cuts are going to have on us, and be our fighter in leadership and on the floor of the Senate for the judiciary to be treated fairly, and to communicate with your colleagues about what this really does mean to their constituents, and not just to the judges or the staff members that we've been talking about, but really to the what the impact will be to your constituents here. So I thank you for this opportunity, and I'm going to run back down to West St. Paul and handle the rest of my afternoon calendar.
Before Judge Knudsen, could you just briefly, as you share with us, what you did this morning and what's facing you this afternoon?
Well, this morning, trying to schedule things is difficult because we have set calendars. So I had a fairly complex civil motion with five attorneys in front of me this morning at 8:30, and that ran till about 9:20, and they're arguing about a taking and a negligence case and combining or separating the cases. The trial's coming up in April. There's discovery is still outstanding, according to one side, but not according to the other side, and trying to figure out how we can economize the use of the court time and the party's time, and either have a shortened first step of the trial, or can we do it all in one court proceeding so we can avoid the expense of for all the parties for almost two full-blown hearings, almost on the same issue. So it's. But it's a very interesting question of law that I've got to try to figure out. Then I had about 20 other cases, variety of divorce, unlawful detainer, orders for protection, harassment restraining orders, and then four divorce pretrials. And our struggle is to try to make sure those cases don't just come into court for an appearance and then leave, but that we actually can spend some substantive time with them, try to get those cases resolved. And fortunately, all four of my divorce pretrials were resolved today, and that final agreements were placed on the record. And that's the satisfaction that I feel as a judge if I can get those cases resolved. So this afternoon I get to go back and hear about nine implied consent cases and talk about drinking and driving.
We're glad that you are here.
Sometimes I wonder, Mr. Chairman.
I'm curious because, and I know the answer, but I want your thoughts on the fact that if you are tied up, the public defender is tied up, there's a great potential for losing that person and having you sit there and wait for.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was my day yesterday. I had about 24, no, I had 18. We were able to split the calendar amongst another judge. I had 18 misdemeanor trials yesterday afternoon, and so the public defender was caught running between two different courtrooms, and so we're trying to get the prosecutor and the public defender together to try to resolve these cases. And so sometimes I'm on the bench and just picking up the phone and telling the clerks in the other courtroom to send the public defender down to my courtroom. And so it's kind of who's going to make the loudest demand on the time for that of that public defender. And so but that's you're absolutely right. You knew the answer to the question, and it's a dilemma. So you really can't shortchange any piece of the judicial system, and the same thing goes with civil legal aid. I mean, some of these divorce cases are often intractable, and the emotion and everything else. And we just thank our lucky stars when an attorney shows up on these divorce cases. But two or three of my cases this morning were pro ses, and so I'm spending an inordinate amount of time making sure they understand what they're actually doing by giving up spousal maintenance claims. And then spending a lot of time trying to figure out what they really mean in their divorce papers and whether they really have the right language and they've checked the right boxes on the pro se documents that the courts have kind of prepared for pro se litigants. But you're absolutely right. We need all these pieces, but we need them funded to the fullest extent you can, because the crumbling effect on society is tremendous, and it impacts the lives of these families and the safety of our communities. As you saw, if we don't know if somebody should be driving or not driving, because we're not able to process the conviction and get that to the Department of Public Safety on time. We're not able to quash the warrants or get them put into the computer in time. And then it's a question of priority and who do you want us to put at the bottom of the list? That's the struggle we have, and those are the tough decisions you're going to have to make with your funding decisions. So.
Well, I want you to know that we are concerned about the way you do business, and it's an important issue. That's why we're here. Unfortunately, the governor wasn't here.
Not appropriately.
But going back, so we're looking at it. I'm curious to know how many these cases go to a jury.
Depends on how reasonable the parties are, reasonable the public, reasonable the prosecutor is, and whether the client really believes that they did something wrong. So, I mean, obviously, the majority all plead out, and the more time we have to spend and just talk about the case to somebody that appears in front of us. You know, I kind of walk them through. Okay, so I say, let's pretend we're having the trial right now, and I kind of walk them through, and do you believe the police officer is going to say anything different than what's in his report? And do you believe the police officer? Should I believe the police officer? And what do you think I'm going to do if that happens? Or, I mean, we just, it's time with the parties. It's the attorneys spending time with the parties. It's the attorneys having the time to talk to each other. And eventually they get resolved, so we can hopefully avoid the expense of trials for everybody. But all of it takes time, and it takes great staff work, and that's basically what we're forced cutting in the judicial branch with these budgets. And believe me, when Ms. DoSalle says we're not sitting on our hands, we're looking at ways of doing business differently, redesigning maybe how the courts operate, looking at functionality, looking at creating, using technology in a bigger and better way and in processing things. But all of that takes time and money and trained, highly trained, competent people. So we're working through it. We're doing our best, and we thank you for doing your best. So
thank you very much.
Have a great rest of the session.
On Judge Lucy Whelan, and then after that, Judge Tom Neville.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name's Lucy Whelan. I'm the Chief Judge in the 4th District. Ms. DoSalle asked me to come and briefly summarize the financial situation in the 4th District. I think I mentioned to you at an earlier, or to some of you at an earlier hearing, that the 4th District came into fiscal year 08 with about a $1.2 million structural deficit, and that was based on increased and unfunded employee costs. And to make that up, we did a couple of things. We cut about $600,000 from our operational budget, and some of you heard about those things. We eliminated our supervised visitation program. We eliminated our civil arbitration program. We eliminated our IT contracts, all travel and education, all law book purchases, our court reporter per diems, and we reduced our conciliation court calendars by a third. And then the remaining $600,000 had to come out of personnel, and so we instituted a hiring freeze in November. And we currently have about 45 vacant positions in our court. And because of the vacancies, we closed our counter and phone services on Wednesday afternoons at 1:30. We also tried to stop doing a few things, but this is a good example of how sometimes it doesn't work. We actually said we were no longer going to conduct criminal record checks for the public. We were going to refer them to the web-based public access. But then what happened is that then they came and asked for certified copies, which they're entitled to do. So we ended up, actually, it takes more time to do that. So now we're reevaluating whether that was smart. But we do have some significant delays right now. Just judgment, default judgment filings are about 6 weeks behind. We're scheduling our conciliation court calendars about 8 weeks from filing. The problem with the governor's recommendation in our district, it would mean another $1.8 million. And I should just point out that that structural deficit I was talking about, I mean, we've got it again in 09, about $500,000 unfunded then. So we're looking at not, it would really be $2.3 million if the governor's recommendations came through. The problem now for our district is we've really made all the cuts we can make operationally, and we're so we're looking at personnel. The hiring freeze doesn't really work long term, and what I think we're now realizing is we're going to have to come up with some more significant ways if we have to make those cuts. We've looked at closing two of our suburban courthouses. The problem with our suburban courthouses is they're not low volume courthouses. Each of them handle about 30,000 cases a year and have anywhere from 1.7 to 2 judges there every day. So what I've heard, and I've heard from Sheriff Stanek yesterday and quite a few of the police chiefs, is that if we close those suburban courthouses, although each courthouse would save us about $350,000 in sort of administrative mid-level staff, it would cost law enforcement in the cities significantly more than that in increased transport costs, booking fees, and things like that. So we're under a lot of pressure not to do that, but in any event, clearly those two of the courthouses would save us about $750,000. We're looking at our self-help center. If we eliminate half our employees there, as Ms. Dosell mentioned, we saw 33 to 38,000 people last year in our self-help center. This is a really significant operation. It's in our, we have a branch in our family court and then one downtown in our general court. And if we cut that in half, that saves us about $350,000. If we cut our staffing in the Domestic Abuse Service Center, which is another thing we could do, five employees, that would save us another $375,000. But there's no way we get to the $2.3 million even doing those things. And so, you know, what we're really looking at now is what don't we do? And I think that, you know, to be responsible, I mean, if we had to make these kind of cuts, the only really responsible way to do it is start prioritizing work and saying there's certain things we're not going to do as a court, because, you know, our biggest challenge is really handling our major cases. We had 130 homicide and Crimsex 1 cases last year, and that is incredibly time-intensive. I have four judge settings this afternoon on homicide and Crimsex 1 cases that we're going to pick trial dates and assign them a judge for trial, and every week we've got about four or five of those set on. So, I mean, that's work we have to do. And then at the end of the day, if we say, well, we're not going to, and our big civil cases we have to do, and our restraining orders, or TROs, those sorts of things, at the end of the day, it's probably going to be minor civil and minor criminal that we're going to say we're not going to do that. Again, the pushback on that from the local governments is the amount of money we raise. We raised $27 million just in Hennepin County last year, just in the criminal area, sort of for these low-level kinds of cases. So you know this probably better than I do, you know, that there are all these consequences for any step we take here. But, you know, it's really dire. We're in a dire straits right now, and a lot of stress among our staff because of our staff vacancies. And so we're looking, you know, really hard at what we're going to do. Thank you.
It's an interesting approach, and I must say, Judge, to appreciate the things that you're doing there and the innovations that you've done. It's unfortunate that we're going to have to redo some of those things for the perhaps the drug courts and all those that, right. That we need innovation. I don't know. Do you use a lot of or any amount of part-time judges?
Yes, we have Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have our entire conciliation court is actually staffed by lawyers, pro tem lawyers who come and sit as judges in our conciliation court. We also have a complement of 15 referees, but at least five of them work part-time. They're not full-time referees. And we're actually, that's an area that we're looking at making some reductions. But using referees is much more cost-effective than judges because you don't have the court reporter and the law clerk, and we generally don't provide them with either of those. So we are doing that.
So you have retired judges, or who else might be doing that?
We have a few retired judges. Recently, we have a few judges now who want to work as retired judges. We went through a long phase where we didn't have very many, but we have a few now. We have three or four.
And do you use referees or something in the housing?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our housing court is staffed by a referee, and then there's a backup referee there. In our probate mental health court, we actually only have one judge. We have four referees there, full-time. In our family court, we have five referees. In our juvenile court, we have two referees, and then we have a part-time referee who does traffic court, and we have a part-time referee who floats, harassments, backup for housing, juvenile traffic. Things like that.
Further questions?
Your Honor, as you know, I do a lot of work in the mental health court in Hennepin County. And, I mean, the four referees, you might save some money, but it's almost the cost of judges. But, you know, you've got one judge, four referees. Those referees do have court reporters. They're going all the time, and it saves a little bit of money to do it, but if you didn't have those four referees, you'd have to have four judges. I mean, there's no trade-off there. So, and Judge Wieland, is it just the manager of the suburban courts? Because I couldn't figure out how you would really save much money by closing them. My office is just about a block away from the Brookdale Center, and you spent a lot of money to build that, so I don't think that's going to have to be around for a while, but the Hennepin County Government Center is only so big, you just can't move everything downtown and save money. I don't see how it works.
The way it would work is we would eliminate that mid-level manager. So by moving the cases to a different courthouse, you don't increase your management staff. So for each courthouse, you save about five employees, sort of that senior court clerk level. But you're right in this respect, certainly. Can we really close two of those courthouses, 60,000 cases? Probably not. I mean, it sounds good on paper, but that's too many cases to move. We could probably close one because Brookdale has a third courtroom to build out. Southdale has a third courtroom, some downtown. We could probably do that, sort of 10,000, 10,000, 10,000. But that saves maybe $300,000 to $350,000, and does that make sense?
Thank you, Mr. It isn't peanuts.
No.
Oh, yes,
it's money.
Senator Neville?
Well, Senator Higgins is here, too, so greetings to the three of you and Mr. Turner. I am the junior judge in the 3rd Judicial District, but the only one who's ever been a legislator, so I guess they thought I could come here and have a little more influence because of that. But I was sworn in on January 10th, and on the 11th we had a district judges meeting where they announced to us that we had about a $1.4 million budget shortfall just in the 3rd District. And so I'm going to explain a little bit about that, and I know that the courts put in a request for a supplemental appropriation, and now instead of likelihood of getting more money, there's a proposal to cut the trial courts another $7 million. And so I'm going to try to address what impact that would have in the 3rd District. The operations budget in the 3rd District is about $12 million a year. About 95% of that is personnel. Only about 800,000 out of that 12 million goes for things like photocopies, Westlaw, postage, travel, things like that. Everything else is personnel. We have already implemented, because of a shortfall in what they call the mandated services budget. I wish I was a little more expert at this budgeting stuff, but the mandated services, maybe Judge Knutson already talked about this, are things like juror expenses, psychological evaluations, interpreter costs, guardian ad litems, in form of pauperous costs. Those are things that the courts have to do. And so we are exceeding that budget, and in the past they've been able to take it a little bit from the general operations fund. There's no surplus left there, but that's the only place left to cut. And so in the third district, we've already cut out of about, there's a total of about 200 FTEs, but 46 of those are judges and court reporters. So about 150, slightly more, total staff, total FTEs. We've already cut 20 just to try to get into structural balance. If we don't get the extra appropriation, we'll have to cut another 10 to 15, I'm told. And if the $7 million cut occurs, another 10 to 15 staff. The net effect of that could be a loss of one-third of all the staff in the 3rd Judicial District, and that would be pretty difficult. And I'll tell you that morale right now is pretty low. There's a lot of anxiety within the court administration offices. We're already going to lose, I think, at least four law clerks among the 23 judges, so there'll have to be some sharing there. The court administrator from Rice County is going to do double duty now with Steele County because the Steele County administrator took the early retirement incentive. And there will be a number of other consequences that will occur if this cut actually takes place. I will tell you that as the rookie judge in the 3rd District, I'm on a learning curve right now, to be sure. But it's a lot more work than just working in a law office, I'll tell you that. It's probably less work than working in a law office and being a state senator, because at least I have some weekend time now. I don't have to go to so many dinners in my evenings. But my evenings are just as busy because I take files home. And maybe that's just a function of me being brand new. But I can attest to you that in our county, which is Rice County, everybody's working really hard, and we've already lost a couple of staff people. And if we have to absorb another $7 million cut, it will be very difficult. We've already closed in the 3rd Judicial District half a day. You've probably heard that from some other districts. So the windows are closed, and those staff people then get to do file work instead of answering people who come to the counter. We're probably going to cut back on conciliation court. Jury terms will be longer, so people will be at risk for serving on a jury for longer, so we don't have to call as many people. But mainly what's going to happen is that the decisions will be delayed. And that has direct consequences to the people involved, but it has collateral consequences because the county will have to, I think somebody else already said, the fine money won't get sent to the state as fast. The county will have to hold people longer and incur costs because those cases can't be processed as fast. So you all know that I was a pretty conservative guy when I was in the Senate, but I always did argue that the courts were a core function of state government, about as core a function as you can get. And so I'm here to ask, I guess there are three of you here, but fight like heck not to let the cuts happen to the courts. It's not my job anymore to tell you where the cuts should be, but if you can't figure out some more fees to add, then find the cuts somewhere other than the courts, because we've already absorbed some cuts because of those extra costs in the mandated service area. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Oh, by the way, last week I did my judge school, and we tried our best. There were 14 new judges, and we all threw a buck into the hat and bought lottery tickets, hoping that we could win $10 million or so, and we all swore that we'd give it to the courts if we did. And I regret to inform you that we were losers. So. Sorry, but we tried. And all of those brand new judges knew that I came here last Thursday, and the hearing had to be postponed. But they were all anxious to know what response we all got. So on behalf of all the new judges that are just starting in the past few months, I think I can tell you they all share the same concern that I have.
Sure. Judge Neville, I've had a chance to talk to you once or twice since you've been sworn in, and you've kind of given me a clue about your workload, which I've shared with people saying it's all true. We are overworked, but could you just kind of share? Because I recall when you were here, you were very meticulous. You like to study the bills, know what's in them, spend some time. And what's life like now for you on a daily basis?
You're not going to try to get me to say publicly that I don't review the files ahead of time.
No. You didn't tell me how long somebody gave you a stat like this, and this is what you got to hear in 5 minutes. And I think that's telling.
I'll tell you just a couple quick stories, and I know you got other people, but you're supposed to get 2 weeks of mentoring where you shadow another judge. Well, I got about 5 days, and then they came and the other two judges in Rice County had recused themselves, and it was a fairly high-profile case, and they came and put the file on my desk, and I didn't even have my robe there that day. So I got my baptism by fire on a reasonably high-profile case involving the Northfield mayor. Mr. Tuma probably knows. But then the next couple of weeks, I was handling, the arraignment calendars, the criminal calendars, where I was handling 50 to 60 cases a day, and that doesn't give you a lot of time to, really give the consideration you'd like to. Everybody who starts being a judge, I suspect, has this idealized thought of dispensing justice, and you find yourself giving a cookie-cutter sentence to a lot of people. For me, I may not be in the best position. I've only been working for 2 months now, but just in the past 2 days, I've taken 8 cases under advisement, so I've more than doubled the number of my cases under advisement, and I'm a little bit frightened about the prospect of losing even a fractional piece of my law clerk just to get that stuff done. And some of them are very, they're significant issues.
Do you have any unpaid clerks?
No, I don't.
Have you thought of that?
I don't. I got a call from a law school student asking if he could intern for me this summer. But you all have interns, legislative interns, and sometimes that takes more time to have an intern to properly train them than they contribute back to you. So I suppose I'd like to do that, but I'm not sure if I can. And it would only be a second-year law student, and my law clerk is very good, and I'm just now learning how to use my law clerk to the greatest efficiency. But if I had to personally research and read and draft all my own orders, I would get quickly very behind.
Thank you very much.
So, thank you very much.
Nice seeing you.
Nice to see all of you.
Michael Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Mike Ford. I'm an attorney with the Quinlevin and Hughes Law Firm in St. Cloud, and I'm here today as president-elect of the Minnesota State Bar Association. President Brian Melendez expressed his regrets, but he had a conflict with today. I'm speaking today only on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association and not for my firm or any other organization that I'm affiliated with. The Bar Association and its more than 15,000 members appreciates the dilemma of scarce resources that this committee and the legislature is facing. The witnesses from the judicial branch have covered the facts well, but let me add the perspective of the practicing bar. With so much information already before the committee, I can abbreviate my testimony to 3 short points. First, the Bar Association joins and supports the judicial branch's point of view. Our experience confirms their numbers. We and our clients have watched and borne the consequences of curtailed operations and decreased or delayed judicial services. Cuts to time-saving and cost-saving programs like court-sponsored civil arbitration and services to pro se litigants have resulted in more work for judges, fewer opportunities for the early resolution of cases, and greater expense to our clients. Second, the court's workload increases during bad economic times because a sagging economy generally triggers a rise in certain types of cases, for example, child support, debt collection, domestic violence, employment disputes, and foreclosures. My own practice is in what's called insurance defense. I'm hired by insurance companies typically. And typically our work and our income goes up when the economy goes down. More people end up starting civil litigation during bad times than during good. All of this will lead to increased pressure on the legal services and public defender systems or legal representation for the indigent. Third, without a court function smoothly, the economy will not function smoothly. The federal and state constitutions guarantee criminal defendants a right to a speedy and public trial. What this means is that civil litigation does not enjoy the same constitutional priority as criminal matters do. And what happens then? Well, the courts have to prioritize cases, which means the criminal docket gets priority, civil cases are delayed. Other jurisdictions whose courts have suffered funding cuts, such as California and New Hampshire, have seen backlogs of 2 or more years before a civil case comes to a hearing. Here in Minnesota, the Supreme Court has established case progress standards for civil litigation that require 90% of civil litigation to be heard and resolved within 12 months. Minnesota courts have, up to this point, met that ambitious standard in the years since the standards were established. Our efficiency in resolving civil litigation has contributed materially to Minnesota's consistently high ranking of its judiciary in surveys of both consumer advocates and business advocates. But Minnesota can't maintain those standards in the face of the cuts that are now being recommended. Without a court system that can efficiently handle its civil caseload, the environment for business becomes unattractive, and businesses become less likely to locate or to invest in the state. Without a court system that functions smoothly, the economy will not function smoothly. I'd like to depart from these prepared remarks to give you a personal comment. I went to school at St. John's University up in Collegeville near St. Cloud. Went to school with a guy by the name of Mike Marchon, who ended up going to the Army, which was not surprising in 1970 when we graduated, ended up becoming a two-star general and retiring as the deputy JAG for the Army. I next ran into him when he was the president of something called the American Center for International Law and Justice. He was here in Minnesota, and in February, a bunch of us got together to have dinner with him, and I asked him, what's this gig all about? And he says, well, the American Center for International Law and Justice set up in Texas, and he's the president, and it's been around about 30 years, and its job is to export American jurisprudence to other countries, to explain to them how to operate their system. And he'd landed a contract, or his college had landed a contract with the country of Kosovo. And so he goes over to Kosovo to line up the Kosovars, about 10 of them, judges, lawyers, police officers, to come over to the United States to find out how to set up their system. And so he planned a trip that would start at the U.S. Supreme Court, get him a tour there, take him down to Texas to go through the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And they stopped him, and they said, well, that's okay for our second trip. But our first trip, we'd like to go to some place called Minnesota. And he said, well, why in the world do you want to go to – it was February. I said, why do you want to go to Minnesota? He said, well, we've had a lot of judges from that place called Minnesota come through here and work in our justice system. And they seemed to know what they were doing. So when we want to go and find out how to set up our system, we'd like to go to that place, Minnesota, first. And that story has meant a lot to me. I heard it from his lips about 2 years ago, because it tells me that when it comes to jurisprudence, we'd all like to think that we're better and above equal. That's the Lake Wobegon effect, I call it. And we all talk that way and think that way. But here we had some people from halfway around the world that told me, you know what, it's true. And that didn't happen by accident. And it took a couple hundred years to get us to that point. And I hate to see some budget cuts move us backwards. That's all I've got, unless you have any questions.
Questions? Only, I feel General Marchand, too. I'm a retired JAG officer, and he was a great officer and a great Minnesotan. Yeah.
He's a rice boy. Thank you.
Mr. Kyer.
Into service. Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to come and lay out our issues before you. I know it's the hour, and I know you got folks behind me, so I'm going to try to be as brief as possible. I always like going behind the court in these presentations because I don't have to make the same arguments again that all the folks in the court system made. I think in terms of the issues of mandated services, of core functions of government, clearly apply to public defenders as much as the court. And I guess from our perspective, we may even argue more so. But I think the message that you all have gotten, and I think that you have gotten over the years, is as Judge Whelan mentioned, I think Judge Knutson also is, this really is an integrated system. And it is a system of when you do take a piece out or you do underfund one piece, the whole system falls apart and it can't function. And we're a vital piece of that, just like the prosecutors are a vital piece of it. Obviously, the courts and the judges are a vital piece of it. So I guess from our perspective, that's our message. Or at least our bigger picture message to all of you, which we, of course, you all know that, and that's the message we've been taking to leadership and to anybody else who will listen to us, frankly, about the needs for this system to be adequately funded on all sides of it. So, Mr. Chairman, as you might recall from when I was here a couple of weeks ago and also in some of the discussions we've had, we have essentially the same situation that the court does. We started out this year when our labor contracts came in, following the state labor contracts, we had a situation where we had some unanticipated costs. We started out this year with about a $3 million shortfall after those labor contracts were put into place. In December of this year, we instituted a hiring freeze. We instituted some other cost-saving measures to try to get control of that. We were determined we weren't going to be coming back this year to ask for additional funding for this biennium, for our regular budget. We have been able to whittle that down to about $1.6 million as of last Friday. My budget person tells me that if we continue this hiring freeze, that we are going to make budget this year. What that has meant to us is we have right now 29 attorney positions that we now have vacant. We have an additional 11, I think maybe now 12, but it's 11 for sure, support staff positions that are currently vacant. Roughly about 5% of the staff, thereabouts 6% of the staff. What we are facing for next year is about a $2.1 million projected deficit, along with the governor's recommendation of $2.7 million in reductions. So really a total of about $4.8 million for next fiscal year. As you can see, if you turn to page 8, I think it's page 8 of the handout, about 88% of the budget is personnel. That's all we do, and you've heard me talk about this before. We don't have a lot of anything else. It's a very labor-intensive function that we provide. Leases and mandated costs are another 7% of the budget. So you're looking at about 95% of the budget being either personnel or being in contractually obligated services, either rents or leases, mileage for folks to be going back and forth to courthouses, those kinds of things. We don't have a lot of options in terms of where we can take some kind of reduction from, and you all know that. In terms of the mandated costs, you've been talked to with the court about the mandated services. With the exception of one small area, everything we do is mandated. So we don't have that option. We don't have that luxury, if you will, of saying, well, we're not going to do this or we're not going to do that.
Which is the one thing that's not
Mr.
mandated.
Chairman, the one area we provide service in that is not mandated is the representation of parents in child protection cases. That's the one area. Mr. Chairman, so that's really kind of our story. And like I said, I know that you've got some other folks that you want to hear from. Just a couple of things, and as I've kind of listened to the testimony. Clearly, as you all know, and your intuition would tell you, is we are sensitive to the economic situation, just like the court had mentioned. Even if you don't believe that poverty causes crime, clearly the pool of folks that we have or that are eligible for public defenders increases in times when economic times are tough. Secondly, just a couple of things to remember. And just as we go down this path of trying to do things differently, try to do things better, we really are at the mercy of the court and other players in the judicial system when it comes to what kind of efficiencies are going to happen, what kind of things are going to go on. One of the areas we talked about last time I was here was ITV. And clearly that's got some efficiencies in it for the court and even for the sheriff maybe in terms of transportation costs. It has some very huge implications. I think Senator Betzold commented on that the last time I was here. Court closures is another one. If, in fact, the court is going to go to a system of closing courthouses or closing suburban courthouses, we would hope, and I'm sure that they will work with us, because obviously that impacts where our folks are going to be, where we're going to need to put resources, or frankly, maybe pull resources out of. If there are 12 courthouses that don't have a sitting judge, if those are the courthouses that end up being impacted, clearly that's an impact on us also, because we have folks traveling the highways all the time to those different courthouses. So, Mr. Chairman, again, that's our story. I wish it was more pleasant. Frankly, I wish that you folks had a little bit better situation that you have to deal with. But again, know that we have been talking to the folks in the leadership. We have been talking to other folks about the entire system, not just public defense, but the entire judicial system, because it is such an integrated piece of what the state does and of a core function. So, and with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for any questions.
System to use for interpreters, for instance, that person rather than drive into St. Paul to go to a hearing could take and go to a closer courtroom.
Mr. Chairman, we've done a number of things in terms of the interpreters, because obviously when we're out of court, we have our own issues in terms of dealing with those folks. Some of the people on our staff we've been using. We've been trying to actively recruit folks that have some language skills. We have used in the past, I know some of our districts have used the telephone interpreters where you can call and get a certified interpreter on the phone. We've used some of those. Our concern has always been not so much where they are, but are they certified? So is the client actually hearing what's being said, and is it being interpreted correctly? So that's really our big issue.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Civil legal and Bruce or Jeremy or both of you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Bruce Beneke, and to my right is Jerry Lane. And Jerry is the current director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, and I'm the former director of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services and now serve as its senior counsel. And I'm grateful for the opportunity. And I also want to thank Kevin Cahir for giving us a little bit of time. He said I owed him. And so hopefully I've repaid that debt. But it's great to be back here. Jerry and I today represent the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition. There should be some materials in your packet. And together we provide civil legal services in all 87 counties of the state on critical civil matters. We're very grateful for, and hopefully they're there. I know they were in the packet last time. We're very grateful for this committee and so many individuals in the Senate, and including some that testified in front of you today in past Senates, for the strong support that the legislature has given to equal justice in Minnesota and to civil legal services. We're very proud of our partnership tradition that we have in Minnesota. It's a bipartisan justice partnership, which includes the legislature. The courts have done a wonderful job overseeing our funding. The Minnesota State Bar Association and volunteer attorneys have been there to help us. And it's been noted that the justice partnership in Minnesota is perhaps the best in the country, and we're very grateful for the legislature's part of it. What I would like to do today is maybe a little bit different. I think this has been a hard hearing to listen to and probably doubly hard for you. And certainly we'll mention the impact a little bit. As Kevin said, certainly sometimes it's advantageous to follow the court and the public defenders because they point out many of the same issues and impacts that affect low-income people that legal services serve. But instead of doing that, Mr. Chairman, members, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about how we spent the extra money that you gave us last year, the good things that we were able to do, how we were able to leverage that money and bring some more resources in, and how we think that the service we provide will help us all to respond to the economic downturn that we face. And then Jerry and I would like to stand for some questions. By way of brief background, before I get into how we spent the money, as you know, has been mentioned before, civil legal services is an essential part of the justice system. We're part of that all overall justice system. Our mission, our job, is a core value in our democracy, is to really give low-income people that meaningful access to the courts to resolve their critical civil legal problems, hopefully in a way that's beneficial and helpful to the family, usually in emergency circumstances. When we testified last year, as most of you know, the Minnesota Supreme Court had a special commission a couple of years ago to study the large unmet need for civil legal services and to make recommendations. As part of addressing that large unmet need last year, we requested the legislature grant us a $2 million increase each year of the biennium to raise our base funding from $12.3 million to $14.3. We're very grateful that this committee and the legislature funded nearly 50% of that request. And we were in the base budget until the last moment when things happened, which I don't think had much to do with civil legal services, but we ended up with the funds as one time. Nonetheless, we're grateful, and we put the money to good use. And how we spent that increase, I've had a chance to talk with some of you, but as has been indicated before, I think by Judge Knutson, one of the major things that happens during economic downturns, and perhaps this time is fueled our economic downturn, is mortgage foreclosures and predatory lending. And we've been able to restore some of the lost positions in the past to address this issue, and so that we have lawyers out there that are representing persons, sometimes being successful in rescinding foreclosures. If we get in early enough, negotiating workouts or restructuring so that people can keep their homes. Also, we have been able to use the training that we've gotten on mortgage foreclosure because we've had more capacity to train volunteer attorneys, thus leveraging your resources, bringing more volunteer attorneys in to help this problem. And we've also spent time in the community training mortgage foreclosure counselors and others on types of legal problems and to get cases to us early when the law can still have an impact in helping families to save a home. So your funding has made it possible for us to respond to this emerging need in the community. As one of the other judges testified, going along with an economic downturn is often many job loss problems, domestic abuse problems, credit kinds of problems. We've been able to restore positions to do more in the consumer area, particularly to help families with credit management problems. We've kept up our very large work in the domestic abuse area, trying to prevent domestic abuse and handling complex family law matters. We've also worked with senior citizens particularly on trying to do preventative work surrounding identity theft and that sort of thing. And finally, with the job loss, there's been an increased number of cases on the unemployment compensation, and we've represented many families trying to get that compensation. Another area that the increased funding has helped us restore positions to do is the whole area of reentry issues. And we've been able to assist a number of persons who are trying to obtain licenses or keep licenses for more entry-level kinds of jobs, including PCA jobs, daycare jobs, and that sort of thing. We've also been able to work to expunge within the law criminal records so that people have a better chance to get jobs, and to expunge landlord-tenant records so people can get a better chance to have housing opportunities. In addition to all of this work, we've continued our work in all the other areas, which I'll mention with, and the funding increase that you gave us last year, as some of you will recall, back in 2001 through 2003, legal aid went through very devastating cuts of its own, a combination of federal, state, and local cuts, and statewide we lost approximately 20% of our revenue base, and we went from having about 179 lawyers statewide to serve the low-income population down to 135. With your support on an incremental basis and the support of others in the community, and then the additional increase last year, we've now been able to get that number of attorneys back up to 170. So we were able to restore 5.5 positions last year as a result of the support that you gave us, as well as save some others that might have been lost because of reduced federal funding. So the net is that your support has allowed us to get close to where we were in 2001 when we were at our high water mark. And speaking of water, there's
I'll get you some.
Okay. Moving on quickly, I'm really proud of the staff that we've been able to hold on to and to restore. Jerry, you want to go? Of course, I work for you now.
Yeah, all right. Keep talking.
All right. We're very proud of that staff and our volunteers. We've been able to recruit a very, very dedicated group of lawyers who stay with us for long periods of time. And even though the starting salary for legal aid is only $39,000 in most parts of the state, we've been successful in keeping people. Senator Higgins, you're wonderful.
Of course I am.
In so many ways. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Excuse to get up and walk around. It's okay.
Thank you. And so Jerry and I are very, very proud of our staff and the retention. And in fact, when our coalition programs were evaluated in 2005 by a national team of experts, we not only got praised for how accountable we are as programs and the justice partnership we have in Minnesota, but for our retention of an outstanding, excellent, and dedicated staff. The funding that you gave us in restoring the positions has allowed us to further diversify our staff to reflect our client makeup, not only by culture and ethnicity, but as testified by the judges with a huge increase in immigrants and refugees in Minnesota. We have our own host of interpretation challenges, and we're able to add bilingual lawyers and bilingual support staff to make sure that all Minnesotans have fair and equal access to our services also. As mentioned, we've also been able, with the help of the funding that you gave us and other sources, to maintain our work in other areas. I've already talked about family and domestic abuse and a little bit about seniors' work. We continue our work in the Social Security and the public benefits kind of area. Our housing work is not only mortgage foreclosure and predatory lending, but we do a lot of work preventing homelessness. We also do a lot of work trying to address and prevent housing discrimination. We work in the immigration area, representing lots of families and helping them to become naturalized or citizens. And again, we've been able to leverage your resources and get additional volunteer attorneys from both corporations and the private sector to help us with that area also, as well as seniors. And then finally, on Jerry's program, as probably the master of this, we do much work in the disability area with seniors and others and making sure that people have access to health care and other kinds of supports that they need. I think the net of all of this, and in conclusion, is that we try our best to hold that money and trust that you give us for the low-income persons of Minnesota and to do our very best job in addressing their important day-to-day individual critical legal needs, and we think that we do a very good job of it. And I think as you think about the future, again, I'm not going to get into the impact very much. I will mention, and most of you know this already, that a byproduct of legal aid's work is, as Judge Knutson commented, we not only, and Susan DeSalle commented, we not only save the courts a lot of money and time because we screen cases out, because we negotiate cases out, and when we're in court, we help the court proceedings to move more cleanly and efficiently. But in a lot of the areas that we work, we actually save taxpayer money or bring money into the state. So you do have very hard decisions, as Judge Knutson indicated, and we understand and respect that you have very difficult decisions. As an administrator, I've experienced that myself in the past, but it never gets easy, no matter what the situation is. And Jerry and I are very grateful for your support, and as Judge Knutson and Judge Neville said, I know that you'll fight for the whole justice system and for access to justice, and particularly in these economic times when, with the economic downturn, the legal and social problems, and which are interrelated, of low-income people increase greatly. And I think that our work on domestic abuse, our work on mortgage foreclosure, our work on credit management, and our work in other areas, what we do is we really are able to help many of these families in crisis because of the economic downturn stabilize their lives, get back on their feet a little bit again to move forward. And in doing this work, I think that not only is it obviously very, very important to the individuals involved, but it really reflects that legal aid has a special role, I believe, in any strategy to address an economic downturn. And so the work that we do, the equal justice that we work that we do, goes to the heart of our democracy. We're very grateful for the investment that you've made, and we encourage you to sustain that investment to the greatest extent possible. And again, we very much enjoy working with all of you and look forward to working with you in the future as we continue the great quest in our society of access to justice and equal justice for all. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'll just add a couple of footnotes to what Bruce said. The first of which is that in addition to doing some of the mortgage foreclosure work that he mentioned, we have, with your help, staff at the Hennepin County Courthouse 4 days a week so that people facing housing court that day can just be directed upstairs where we can give them advice and assistance. And we also provide at the same location backup to volunteer lawyers from some of the large firms in Minneapolis who are willing to help, but they don't have the kind of background. I mean, I've got a lawyer with 25 years of experience in housing court. And he provides backup and mentoring for those private volunteers, so there's really a leveraging impact from your funding to get the volunteer lawyers who are willing to do it but need the backup from an experienced attorney. The second thing I'll mention is the last thing I did before I went home last night was talk to a young woman who got my phone number, who knows how. You know, you hang out in my area long enough, everybody gets your phone number. A single mom, 2-year-old kid. She was evicted in Isani County. She was one of the people who did not get to us. As it happens, she would have had a defense to the eviction, but she didn't know that, and so she got evicted. Judge time was wasted. That didn't need to be if she'd been able to get to us. Court staff time, and these are all things that you've heard about today that we don't have an excess of. Sheriff's office time to carry out the eviction, and after all that is said and done, she can't find any place to rent. She calls landlords. There's an eviction on her record. They say, sorry, we're not interested. So she's blacklisted because she's got an eviction on her record, and she's at major risk of homelessness for herself and her small child, all of which
you can multiply by thousands. And that's what will happen if we have to cut back staff, because that's all we've got to cut. I sympathize for your thankless job, but that's the consequences of having or not having one of our people able to help somebody. We would appreciate whatever you can do.
Thank you. I guess you can really figure that we don't have any money, the courts don't have any money, and what the governor has, he isn't doing all.
We sympathize, believe me.
Mr. Chairman, one last comment. We really appreciate Mr. Turner's work in mentioning the $516,000 in the calculation, and that the impact, as Mr. Lane has indicated, on legal aid would not only be short-term, but perhaps would be sort of a double whammy in terms of the tails. And I appreciate the committee's openness to taking a look at that. And thank you very much. And thank you again for the opportunity and for all the past support. And thank you for the water.
Oh, you're welcome. I would have given you my bottle, but it was about half empty. It would have been tacky.
It's surprising.